evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Melbourne Law School. My name's Carolyn Evans. I'm the Dean of the School, and on behalf of the School and the Institute of Patent and Trademark Attorneys of Australia, it's my great pleasure to welcome you to the third Francis Gurry Lecture on Intellectual Property. We meet today on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I begin by paying my respects to their elders, past and present. Just to ensure that everybody knows, tonight's lecture is being recorded and it will soon be available on the MLS website. The Francis Gurry Lecture on Intellectual Property was established by the Melbourne Law School and the Institute of Patent and Trademark Attorneys of Australia in 2009 in recognition of a very distinguished alumnus of this law school and the Director General of the World Intellectual Property Organisation, Dr. Francis Gurry. We were greatly honoured that Dr. Gurry himself gave the first lecture in 2009 on the topic Intellectual Property, Innovation and Creativity, Future Global Directions. The second Francis Gurry lecture was delivered by Alison Brimlow, President of the European Patent Office, last year on the topic Not Seeing the Wood for the Trees, Is the Patent System Still Fit for the Purpose? So we've had some provocative talkers, some provocative speakers, and I'd like to acknowledge the vision and the generous financial support of the IPTA that has allowed us to establish this as what is now the premier intellectual property public lecture. Tonight's lecture by Mr. James Love, Delinking Intellectual Property from Exclusive Rights, promises to continue the high standards set by our first two lectures and to really cement the place of this lecture in the Australian public lecture scene. I would now like to introduce my colleague, Professor Andrew Christie, the Davis Collison K Professor of Intellectual Property, to introduce Mr. Love and tonight's topic.
Thank you, Carolyn, and I add my very warm and sincere thanks and welcome to you as well. I've been doing more travelling on planes recently than I generally like to do, and I've heard this phrase over and over again, which is that they say at the end of the trip, we know you have a choice of airlines, we thank you for flying with us. But it's actually an important point, and I would say that I know and we know you have a choice of public event to attend. There are many high-quality, intellectually stimulating public events often offered by this law school, and we don't take it for granted that you will turn up on the night. We thank you for the fact that you've made the commitment to come along and see this. I'm confident you'll find that our attempt to provide you with the highest quality speakers on the most important topics is continued, but you'll get to judge that 45 minutes from now. But thank you for coming and making that judgment in the future. I also want to thank the three supporting organisations for this evening, that is to say, in addition to IPTA, with whom we co-present this, the three organisations being IP Australia, FICPI Australia, and the Licensing and Executive Society of Australia and New Zealand. It is simply the fact that without that additional support, we wouldn't be able to bring James to Melbourne and have him, as he is going to do, go on to Canberra to speak tomorrow, to Brisbane the day after, and Sydney the day after that. The additional support of IP Australia, FICPI Australia and Lesans allows us to do that. And to the representatives of those organisations here tonight, I say a very sincere thank you for that transformative and foundational additional support. I had a very enjoyable, long and engaging breakfast discussion with James Love this morning. He said many striking things, but a couple of which stuck in my mind and that I'll mention now. First of which is, in passing, it was very much an in passing comment, he sort of mused, he goes, I often wonder if I should have been an academic rather than an activist. Now, he could easily have been an academic of the highest calibre. His academic qualifications attest to that. Amongst his degrees are a Master of Public Administration from the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard and a Master of Public Affairs from the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton. He's also, in fact, worked in academia amongst many other interesting jobs. He's been a lecturer at Rutgers University and a researcher at Princeton University. But it is to activism that he's dedicated the majority of his working career. And it's a long dedication because he mentioned in passing to me this morning how he spent 13 years living in Alaska and casually said, oh, and I established two NGOs while I was there. It's not about his Alaskan NGOs, though, that we are hearing him tonight. It's about his current position. He's the director of Knowledge Ecology International. Now, Knowledge Ecology International's mission is to ensure that the most marginalised people in the world have their economic and cultural positions and well-being enhanced through the management, the innovative and creative management of that most important renewable resource, human ingenuity. human knowledge, human creativity, human information. And if you think that's a bit woolly, if you think that's a bit, you know, warm and fuzzy, and think that maybe this is just playing around, well, I can attest to the opposite, but if you go and have a look at the Board of Advisors for KEI, the three advisors are Joseph Stiglitz, not a warm and fuzzy, but a very well-known Nobel Prize-winning economist, Sir John Sulston, a Nobel laureate in medicine and physiology, and Amartya Sen, who doesn't need to have a Nobel Prize, but whose contributions are so phenomenal that you all know those three names, I know. So that shows you that KEI is a serious organisation seeking to do the most important thing, which is to ensure that intellectual property, not intellectual property rights, intellectual property, the productivity of human ingenuity, is appropriately managed to ensure that the well-being of all, including the most marginalised, is enhanced. Now, James, what I'm about to say is of no real significance to you, but for what it's worth, which is probably very little, I'm very glad that you didn't become an academic. And that's not because I fear competition. Firstly, we operate in different market spaces, so the elasticity of the product supply wouldn't have us overlapping. But secondly, and much more importantly, because we need in the activist NGO sector such important, deep and innovative thinkers as yourself. It's comforting, but more importantly, it's very invigorating to academics such as myself to know that the small part that academics play in producing research and some insights on things like intellectual property rights and law can be taken up and much more importantly used to influence policymakers to get it right. So I'm really glad that in fact I introduce you as an activist and not an academic. So ladies and gentlemen, all I need to do is ask you to join with me in giving a very warm welcome to the podium to deliver the third Francis Gurry Lecture on Intellectual Property, the Director of Knowledge Ecology International, James Love.
Thank you very much for that. Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. It's quite an honor to be invited to give this lecture this is not my first time in Melbourne, and thank you for the opportunity to be in this great city. I'd like to hope this isn't going to cause too much feedback. I'm wired up like crazy. Can you hear me okay in the back? Do I even need the microphone? I guess I've got double microphones, right? So I'm not going to, that's the problem. Before I came here tonight, I was talking with Andrew, Professor Christie, about my presentation, and part of this series is I'm supposed to write a paper for a journal, and in preparing to come here, I spent a fair amount of time sort of working on the paper, and then I realized that if I'm going to come here and talk to a room full of people, if I just tried to read the paper, it would be very difficult to do and probably not very interesting. And it'd probably be, because I tend to want to sort of make more technical arguments or, cite all kinds of different things. And I thought it might be more appropriate if I could just kind of explain a little bit about what I've been working on, why I was probably invited here, and why, it's important and it may be important to you or at some point it may become some of these initiatives are at various stages of moving forward, but it really introduced you in a way to more of a social movement that's looking at different ways to reform the intellectual property system, not just to sort of beat back and push back on intellectual property per se, not just purely to sort of reduce the rights that people that develop drugs or authors or musicians have, but to sort of rethink at a very fundamental level some of the basic premises you have about the way it should work. And so in this particular talk, the title was Delinking Intellectual Property from Exclusive Rights. Now, when I go back and I look at the history of intellectual property development, what I would consider the fairly recent history, the sort of last couple hundred years, you'll notice when you go back a few centuries ago, the term intellectual property is a fairly recent term after the creation of the World Intellectual Property Organization. People didn't really used to use that term very much before. There was a period when these things were referred to as privileges, monopoly privileges, that sort of thing. There was kind of this war of words about whether or not you could refer to something as an author's right versus a printer's privilege. And there's this sort of this initial, basically, fight about how people were going to take this movement to create legal rights to decide who can publish, who can distribute, who can use inventions and things like that, the things that we think of the modern intellectual property system. There was a history of, it's always been the case that the intellectual property system has been part of a bigger ecosystem of ways that you support innovation. If you look just, for example, at medical research or drug development, the development of new drugs, there's lots of different things going on. There is grant systems that are done by governments. Particularly in the United States, the National Institutes of Health. There's the patent system, which creates incentives for people by granting these temporary monopolies. There's now like a proliferation of non-patent intellectual property systems relating to giving people the exclusive rights to rely upon data that you have for developing a new drug. If you develop a drug for an uncommon disease, some kind of special market exclusivity or testing that's associated with children, there's now special intellectual property rights you can get or special rewards you can get in the United States for being the first to register a drug for a drug like malaria in the United States, an area where it's not really used very much. But there's an expansion of what you'd call intellectual property, but sort of the fundamental model is that we're used to is the idea that if you develop a product for a new drug, that part of the idea is that you grant a monopoly on a drug. That's the basic reward if you want private investors to get involved. They may get the monopoly through a patent. They may get it through some exclusive rights on test data. You may create a special intellectual property right around orphan drug protection or something like that. But at the end of the day, it's really about giving one company the right to sell the product and to tell other people that they can't offer competing products. The idea is it's expensive to develop drugs, and there has to be a way of doing it. And we just decided that we didn't want to rely entirely upon the government giving out grants and running this as some kind of a state-run enterprise. It's sort of this idea that you'd have the private sector. Now, within the drug system, just some basic facts to sort of motivate what some of the problems might be for that. One is that it's quite expensive for society to grant monopolies on new drugs. And if you have a monopoly on a new drug, companies can be really, really aggressive. Like Herceptin, for example, is a product that's used for the treatment of breast cancer. It's sold by Roche, which has acquired the company in California that initially developed the drug. And Herceptin can cost is anywhere from $50,000 to $100,000 for treatment for a woman that needs it. It's an effective drug for a certain fraction of the women that have breast cancer, that have HER2-positive breast cancer. It's a fairly recent drug. It's a life-changing, it's a game-changing, life-saving drug for a lot of people. It generates right now about $500 million U.S. Per month for Roche for this one product. There is almost no access to this drug in developing countries. I wouldn't say there's none. I mean, there is some access in developing countries, but it's not remotely close to what you'd have in a place like Australia or the United States or Canada or Germany. It's really only a few people very unequal access to this product. I know we approached at one point, I think in India, the price of this drug for a single injection is about between $2,500 and $3,000 per injection. You need for a course of treatment one injection every 3 weeks for a year. So there are some people in India that can do this, but not very many. So that's the system we have to reward the developers of Herceptin. You give them $6 billion a year for a product for as long as the monopoly lasts, and that some fraction of the world population has access. This drug is so expensive that even places like Australia or the United States or different European countries fought within their insurance system. They didn't really want to make the drug readily available to women with breast cancers. In some cases, they had to sue to have access to it. There would be disputes about the efficacy of the product, pretty much because it was just too damn expensive. Now, that's just a story of one cancer drug. The National Cancer Institute in the United States, they have a list of what they call the alpha cancer drugs. It's the 100 new molecular entities. There's more than 100 drugs because they have those same new molecular entities are then reformulated and sold in different combinations. But the 100 is essentially the core drugs that they recommend today for the treatment of cancer. Over half of those were invented since January of 2000, or within the last 11 years. So it's a fairly recent group of drugs that we use right now to treat cancer. In even the highest income areas, there's fairly restricted access to the more expensive drugs that come out. It may be that you're not available for them until you've had sort of until other therapies have failed or something like that. There are people that countries where they do not have insurance are quite a disadvantage. But then the majority of the world's population, the majority of people that would benefit from those products just don't have access at all. The World Health Organization has a list of what they call the essential medicines list. And it's published every couple years. And they go through and they look at drugs that health systems, it's primarily a list that's used in developing countries to determine what kind of products you can get through the public systems in developing countries. They have what they call a core list, and they have a supplemental list. And they have no chemotherapy drugs on the core list, and they have about 20 on the supplemental list. And none of the 20 that are on the supplemental list are patented. They're all older drugs. They're all 17, 18, 20 years or older products. And that's been the case for a long period of time. What that means is that the World Health Organization has decided that the patent system has made patented cancer drugs, they're just defined as just not essential by the World Health Organization for the majority of the world's population. Now, that's cancer. If you look at AIDS, it's an area that I work in a lot. And when triple therapy was, before 1996, everyone that had AIDS was thinking they were going to die. People that got AIDS didn't make any difference whether you lived in Africa or you lived in Manhattan or you lived in Melbourne. I mean, there wasn't anything that was really working for AIDS patients before 1996. And so the people that had AIDS would get reverse mortgages on their house, they begin to liquidate their assets. They just kind of look toward a reasonably short life. And then in 1996, with the development of triple therapy, it was just kind of a remarkable story. And because it was a new disease, there weren't really any generic therapies that you could turn to. It was just really the patented drugs, or it was nothing. And the initial prices for AIDS drugs was, as you see in cancer drugs today, the prices are not that different from India to Germany. I mean, the companies try and charge relatively the same price. That was really what was going on back in the 90s. And there was this social movement that I was part of, and others were part of, to attack the patents in developing countries, to sort of go after the strong patent protection, because it was considered to be, most of the people who had AIDS, for cancer, it's not as if the only people that get cancer live in OECD countries and nobody in developing countries. I mean, it was, you know, the incidence is probably not that much different if you adjust it for how long people live. But if you look at cancer, AIDS rather, almost everyone that had AIDS, the vast majority of patients were living, right now 94% of the people that are HIV positive, according to the UN, live in developing countries. And so most of the people that had HIV were living in developing countries. And I believe in South Africa, I believe in the year 2000, there was about, and that was a country that had millions of people that were considered HIV positive. I think there was 20,000 people in the whole continent of Africa that were receiving antiretroviral treatment. Back in 2000, about 11 years ago, and the price of drugs went in a very short amount of time, really from the year 2000 to the year 2001, was really brought down from around $10,000 a year in South Africa. I mean, the possibility was brought from about $10,000 down to about $350 per year. Now it's under $100 per year for that cocktail, and it really has transformed the amount of people, the number of people throughout the world that have access to that drug. And this story has been played out in a lot of different cases where once the prices come down, the access barriers really fall. It's not the only problem you have for all of these illnesses, whether it's cancer, whether it's AIDS, or whether it's a different disease. There are all sorts of other problems in treatment. And I don't want to overstate the role of the price of the drug as the only thing, but it's a pretty important thing. And whenever there's been a chance to sort of push down the price, that's been a problem. So in that kind of situation, the reaction of the companies, or the reaction is always to come back and push back and to say, if you don't really permit this period of the temporary monopoly, you're not going to have new drugs, because it's not just about the access to the drugs that you have today, it's about the access to the drugs you're going to have tomorrow. So the challenge always is, when you're trying to deal with an access issue, part of the challenge is to figure out how do you actually deal with the dynamic cycle? How do you get the next generation of drugs? Could you basically do away with the idea that you're going to have a monopoly on drugs? Could you decide that drugs should be made, the cost of making a copy of a drug? And could you sort of reinvent the system in a way where you could have more universal access to the product? Now, I just want to switch gears for a second from the medicine thing and talk a little bit about the internet first and then about software. If you think of the internet today, I'm sure that everyone in this room not only uses the internet, but probably uses the internet all the time. If you were to go back the early 90s, just not that long ago, very few people knew what the internet was. Very few people were using any kind of email or were using network. And the people that were using networks were accustomed to the idea that if you used a network, everything was going to be paid in kind of a metered basis. You'd be paying per packet, you'd be paying per hour. It was very expensive. If you look at the prices people paid for data and for online information, 20 years ago, they were really astronomical. It was quite difficult. And the internet came along as sort of a completely new form of telecommunications network. It was designed by the users. It was designed by people that wanted to use the network. It wasn't really designed by the phone company, the phone company's strategy is to sort of extract as much money from the consumers as possible. That's what the drug companies try and do. They try and extract as much money as possible from the consumers or from the health insurance or whoever they can. And that's what the phone companies are trying to do. The phone companies were essentially suppressing a lot of developed new technologies, but they were just essentially making it just impossible to develop a network that was very valuable and very useful to people. So the internet was developed outside of the phone network by hobbyists, by people working on government grants, by engineers. They kind of like, you know, this is a stealth mode. They just kind of developed it outside of the normal network. And there was attempts by the phone companies to try and shut it down because they thought it was a threat to the overall network and things like that. And in some ways it was, but it was a threat to the old business model. Well, the internet today, what it is I don't know how you guys pay for internet, everybody in the room, but for many people, you pay like a monthly fee for some kind of connectivity to the internet. But what you actually do when you're connected to the internet, in terms of every time you send an email, every time you look at a web page, you don't pay for the little marginal cost of things. You don't pay for making a copy of something that you do to just transmit information. You pay for basically kind of the fixed cost of the networks, the kind of things that need to be paid for but are kind of insensitive to volume. Now, if you think of what happened to the internet, it was probably the biggest change in the way it was comparable to the development of the printing press, maybe even bigger. I mean, it was like just huge, the differences that it sort of has made to society at every single level. And it's really expanded access that people have to all sorts of information. It's changed the way we are socially, it's changed political structures, it changed everything. But one thing it did is it sort of liberated us from the idea that you had to pay on the margin, that you're always paying a lot. Now, if you go to the drug market, if you were to sort of just buy out the patents of the drug companies on any given annual basis and just say to the companies, look, I'll just take the AIDS market right now. It's about, I think it's about $13 billion internationally right now. If you were just to say, here's a check for $13 billion, but we'll make the drugs ourselves. We'll just buy out. We'll just give you the same amount of money you get right now, but we'll just buy out from you. Well, if you were to do that, you could they would be made whole. They would make the same amount of money, but you could completely expand the number of people that had access to the products because it's actually very cheap to make a copy of a drug. It doesn't cost $3,000 to make an injection of Herceptin. It probably costs $20 to make an injection of Herceptin. I mean, there's just this huge difference between what the prices are for drugs, for example, and what people charge. And so, in a way, what you're trying to do is to find a way to get money to the drug developers that's not connected to the cost of making a copy of a drug. Just like in the internet, the big innovation was to create a way to get money to the phone companies without having it be based upon the number of minutes that you spoke, you know, on the phone, or the number of messages you sent or something like that, to kind of liberate it from that kind of thing, to move it to more of a flat rate pricing model. Now, I mention that because you can go a certain amount of distance in just sort of pushing back on the prices, beating up on the IPR system, and trying to create exceptions and just, you know, basically make the IPR system weak. But you can't go as far as you'd like to go in some cases to really, really change life as dramatically as the internet changed everybody's life by changing the way telecommunications was charged and the way that market was essentially developed. So the trick here, I think, is to de-link the idea that the way people get paid is through the cost of a copy being faced by a user, that you want to be a situation, whether it's a person getting a drug, or it's a person listening to a song, or it's an ebook or something like that. You want people to be able to freely access and use academic journals, ebooks, drugs, all sorts of different things. But you can't do it by just eliminating the ability to charge high prices unless you come up with some other kind of mechanism to basically think about how you're going to pay people off. Because internet's free on the margin, it's not free, period. I mean, people do pay for it, but they just don't pay for it in the same way that they used to. And that's sort of the basic kind of, that's part of the strategy in some of the things. Now, I'd like to just walk you through a few different examples of how this might play out or how people are talking about it. I'll talk about the AIDS market in the United States right now. We have right now several thousand people that are The United States has about 1.1 million people that are HIV positive in the United States. About 24% of the people that are HIV positive in the United States get antiretroviral drugs. That's really too low. It's too low for a reason. It's because the best-selling AIDS drug in the United States is $24,000 a year, Atripla. Now, because the drugs are so expensive, people don't really want to make the drugs available. They don't want to pay for them if they can. We have state-run programs for people that are poor. 70% of the patients in the United States that get antiretroviral drugs get them through a government program for people that are poor. To qualify, you have to meet the income guidelines. Because of the financial crisis and the lower rate of growth right now, the United States now has thousands of people on wait list in the United States of America that can't get antiretroviral drugs because the state governments don't do it. A lot of people don't even know they're HIV positive. In a lot of jails in the United States, they don't test people until they leave jail because they don't want to test them while they're in jail because then that would create an obligation to pay for the drugs for the people. They found that if you are on antiretroviral drugs, your chances of retransmitting the drug go down by about 95%. The U.S. gets about 50,000 new cases per year. So not only are we sitting on 1.1 million people are HIV positive, but we have 50,000 new cases a year. So we should be treating more people, and we should raise the numbers, and we should try and you have all kinds of health problems where you don't treat people either. They end up consuming other parts of the healthcare system. They get sicker, and you end up paying for it there. And the drugs are fairly cheap. You can make that $24,000 cocktail. You can buy it today for about $200 from India, except for the patent system. We can't buy them. It's not legal in the United States. Now, the antiretroviral market went from the United States a little over $5 billion to $9.5 billion, or $9.3 in about 4 years, the last 4 years. It's almost doubled. For us to actually be anywhere where we should be on treatment, we'd have to go, to $18 billion, $25 billion. It's hard to tell. The trajectory, it's kind of a scary trajectory. So there's a bill in the U.S. Senate that says, let's just eliminate the whole monopoly on AIDS drug in the United States, and let's create a $3 billion a year prize fund to reward people that are successful drug developers. We're developing probably about one antiretroviral drug per year right now. $3 billion, and that's just out of the U.S. market. That doesn't include the rest of the world. We're only about 24% of world GDP. Doesn't include what Europe would contribute, what Australia would contribute, what developing countries would contribute. But the idea is we just basically just start buying generic drugs in the United States, and we'd be able to eliminate our wait list for people that can't get the drugs right now. We'd go to much higher levels of treatment in the United States. We'd cut our purchase bill by probably, we're spending $9.5 billion. We'd probably save $8 billion on the amount of money we spend on the drugs. We'd save a lot. So you could easily pay for the prize fund thing and have a lot of money left over. And that's actually a good thing for the United States right now because we actually are running huge deficits and we're cutting back all kinds of other essential programs. It's not a bad thing to have a program that could actually expand access at a lower cost than what you have today. Most healthcare reforms are based on rationing access. This is based on kind of economics of abundance. The economics of abundance is the idea, a little bit like the internet, that on the margin, things aren't so expensive. So you can actually allow people to have kind of like extensive access on the margin if you can figure out what it's going to really cost you to essentially say, sort of basically kind of keep the thing going. If I just want to talk a little bit about the drug market, internationally, only about 9% of the turnover of drugs is spent on research and development. And of that, most of the drugs that are developed are medically unimportant drugs. They're just drugs that are developed because companies can sell them because just the way the reimbursement systems are set out. They're not considered medically important, and a fair amount of the money that's classified as R&D is done basically to position for marketing purposes, to develop relationships with doctors and things like that. as consultants to clinical trials and things. It's an incredibly expensive system. We spend over $500 billion a year in higher drug prices because of the patent system. You're not getting back $500 billion worth of innovation in the drug sector. It's an incredibly inefficient, unfair, unhumane, you know, just messed up system. It doesn't deliver you the goods. There are millions of people that are completely outside the system that suffer and die because they don't have access to things, and it could be fixed. And it could be fixed for less money than what you're currently spending on the system. That's a little bit about how the sort of delinking strategy would play out within the drug area. Now, I'll talk just another thing about drug development, and that is that part of the problem in drug development, we're not really developing that many new drugs every year, despite the fact that costs keep going up and the outlays on R&D are skyrocketing. It's been relatively, I think it'll go up this year, but it's been relatively level for the last, or almost declining actually for important drugs. But the there's an access to knowledge problem. The fact of the matter is people that are doing drug development, they have the science is an issue. You have to try and figure out what it is that you should be doing. Nobody's that smart. But collectively, if people share information, if you share access to materials libraries, if there's more openness about both failed experiments and successful experiments, if technology is more widely licensed, if it's people don't sort of aren't so proprietary, if they're not sort of blocking off competitors in areas, things would potentially be better. And I think the access to knowledge is considered an extremely important part of drug development by people in the field. But the incentives are what? The incentives are to either keep things as a trade secret or to patent them and restrictively license them, because that's how you make money out of the research you do. That's what universities are being told to do, too. That's what universities, researchers do, they're working on government grants. That's what private companies and startups do. Now, everybody knows it would be great to people get a lot of praise if they actually share and open source the research and are willing to collaborate. But you know, there isn't a lot of economic incentive to do, so it doesn't happen as often as it should. So one of the ideas is to introduce this idea of an open source dividend for the development of new drug development. How would that work? Well, one of the proposals is to say that you take 5% of the reward from developing a new drug and not give it to the person who sells the drug, but give it to the community of people that open source their technology. The idea is that the open source part of the equation is really underdeveloped, and the drug developers themselves are kind of standing on the shoulders of this whole community effort to build the science in a certain ways. I mean, they sort of come in at the end when things begin to kind of gel and they can sort of see where things are going, but they're not really doing everything, and they need that other effort by the community. So the open source dividend would be, you'd make a business decision to either share or not share. And if you shared and were open, you'd be eligible for this pile of money that would be called the open source dividend. And if you didn't, you'd have to depend on your licensing and your restrictive agreements and things like that. But it would begin to internalize the idea that society values the open sourcing of research. And they're, you know, we're willing to set aside a certain amount of money for it out of the existing system of how you're already paying for things. But correcting a current problem, which is that the only incentive you give to people are people that are the most restrictive and most proprietary type things. So the open source dividend, that's a relatively new idea in the sort of whole reform area, but that's an idea to sort of create financial incentives and rewards for people that do things in drug development that are socially beneficial by sharing. You could even do that without even introducing the prize fund. You could just make that as some obligation on people that sell drugs. They could just have to, it could be like an open source royalty back to the people whose benefits that they had. You could do it that way, or you could do it in connection with a more radical thing like the prize fund. But that's another part of this work program people are working on. Now, I want to talk, I don't want to I don't know how much time I've got here, but so I'm going to shift gears from drugs a second and talk brief first about rock and roll music, and then about libraries and schools. To just give you a couple examples of some of the other areas where people are working on this delinkage agendas. Now, some years ago, there was a seminar in New York called this Blur Seminar, where the working group in this later moved to Banff, Canada, to work on this problem. They ask, the working question was, they ask performers of music, they ask them, the issue was, artists want to be paid, and how do you do it? And this was a period when, you know, people were, you know, really beginning to really look really hard at this. How do you get yourself out of the fact that, you know, Napster was going on, there was all these battles on DRM, there was, you know, all these sort of things about what was going to happen to the livelihood of people that created music. And some of the, we're still not out of the woods, that's still being kind of played out in terms of, one possible solution is that you create kind of a police state where the government just tracks everything. That I was just at Geneva at WIPO, and there was a gentleman from was running a music service in China, and he was saying, well, he's saying that the technical protection measures don't work, but traceability does work. And, you know, your image of how great it is to be tracing what everybody reads or uses of information is, you know, I just can't imagine that people don't understand that there's some problems in that area. I don't think you really want complete traceability of what everyone reads and does all the time as your solution to the musician's problem. Anyway, but some people were, what was great about the file sharing, you know, particularly before it was kind of became like illegal everywhere, was that you had access to so much music all of a sudden. You were discovering things. People that were kind of forgot about music became really interested in music. It was, you know, a lot of people my age, the last music they listened to was stuff they listened to when they were in college or something like that. They just sort of get out of the thing. But then with Napster, you'd start looking for something that was familiar, but then you'd stumble into things that you were less familiar with, and you started to rediscover music and become kind of in love with music again for a while. It was fun, actually. It was completely apart from the fact that it was free on the margin meant you were free to essentially discover things. It wasn't, and a lot of people would pay a fair amount of money for the ability to have access to all that music without having to pay, you know, so much, you know, to test out a particular tune or something like that. It's kind of this idea of free on the margin versus free overall. So, you know, there's a group of activists that are trying to move to this flat rate pricing model where you have like compulsory license on the catalog, and you allow people to reintroduce kind of legal versions of file sharing, and you just basically just, file sharing is also cool because it was organized by fans. It was organized by users. It wasn't really organized by some record company trying to get you to listen to their stuff. It was just people that like music but just turning on their friends to different kinds of music. It was sort of a different experience. It was very cool. So, but to solve the money issue, which is the big problem on these things, some people recommended that they, you know, that you overcome the exclusive right and you have like a $5 per month fee on your cell phone or, you know, some other, and people are, you know, and it may end up there. We don't really know where this is headed, but certainly there's kind of that model. Well, the Blur Banff model was different. It was radically different in the following way. Its premise was not that you organize the music market around the interest of the sellers of the music. It was that you organize it around the interest of the consumers of the music, of the fans. So the idea was, suppose that the political power was all in the fans and there was no political power from the record companies or the big labels or even the musicians themselves, that it was pretty much the, you know, people here, and you could organize it any way you want. It would not be obvious that the best system would be a system where there was no money flowing to the artist. You may decide that you really wanted to support certain kinds of artistic things, or you might not. Well, if there was some kind of a compromise, suppose that Suppose the government sort of imposed and said, look, everyone's going to have to support music because as a government, we love musicians more than we do any other occupation, and they're going to have some special entitlement, and everyone has to give money. Well, if you were to have something like that, one way you could implement it is that you could choose what intermediary gave your money to the artist. Now, like a typical collection society model would be that they'd look at the number of downloads that you'd have to music, and you'd count it like you would, and you'd give the people that had more, it was like a linear relationship between the number of times people listened to your music and the amount of money you'd get. That's sort of a typical classic, very much like the way a record store would operate, or iTunes would operate. I mean, it's essentially, you look at the traffic. A different way to look at it is you'd say, well, I don't really think Madonna needs my money. I don't really think Mick Jagger needs my money. I want to give my money instead to a group that just pays for their backup singers, or old blues artists, or some of these old people that made great tunes that were kind of covered by more successful commercial artists, but were the real influences. Or I just love bagpipes, or I'm crazy about classical music, or I want people to do classical music, I just don't want to have to listen to it myself, but I think it's, you know, culturally it's probably important. So, or you can have kind of a logarithmic scale as to how you reward people, so that if you're more popular than everybody else, you make more, but not as much more as what they call the Britney effect. The Britney effect was that, this was about when Britney was a star, the female performer, was that a very small number of very famous artists get almost all the money. And they get ridiculous sums of money. And everybody else basically waits on tables. That's kind of the Britney effects story. There's a lot of work on that. So some people would like different things. So the idea was that nobody could really agree on the best way to reward artists. If you look at the people in this room and they wrote down the best way to do it, you'd probably have quite a few different answers to that. So the competitive intermediaries idea was that suppose there was four different collection societies free to do whatever they wanted to do in terms of distributing the money, and you got to pick the one that did it the way that you liked it. And so suppose one said we'll have like a flat income curve, and the other one said we'll have like, you know, a steep income curve. People that like the flat income curve, give it to that group. The people that like the steep income group, give it to that one. Another group says, you know, we just like bluegrass. That's it, you know. People that like that could give it to that. If you had a system like that, you'd essentially have the public acting like a patron of the art, not in a way that mimics the marketplace, which we've just become kind of assume as some law of nature that came down from like Moses from the mountains on the tablets or something like that. But we'd be reinventing the best way to support the art in ways that really met our kind of interest and ideas. And we'd kind of break the mold, actually. We'd change things. Well, this is a very, Bleuler Banff model turns out to be very controversial within the music area because people are so committed to the legitimacy of the marketplace model that they think it's unnatural. It's like a dog having sex with an alligator or something like that. They just don't like the idea that you would ever move away from a dollar per song kind of a model. What they really want, you know, is to sort of retain something that looks like a record store, but just without asking permission, you know, to use the music or something. So the Bleuler Banff model is kind of like a different way. Now, that actually spawned this idea of the competitive intermediaries. That spawned a whole series of other thinking about how you could look at ebooks, how you could look at software, how you could look at open source research in different kinds of areas, where there would be people paying in based on different criteria, but having freedom to pick the intermediaries which would support the endeavor that they were really interested in. For example, this will be my last thing. Let's just take ebook, which is right now about ready to go the way of the same crisis the music has. It's coming, you can tell. I mean, the ebook platform is becoming really important now. And it's happening very fast. And it's fairly easy to hack and crack the DRMs on the ebooks. And so people are kind of worried about that. But there's also The other thing that's happening is just the interest there is in having more universal access, like the drug thing. Do you really want a world where you have very unequal access to scholarly works, for example, or scientific journals or writing things? I mean, the whole world is actually part of this equation. You can rapidly think of massive increases in, and you see it happening anyhow through the internet, because a lot of content's moving in that direction, but it could really be done in a more systematic way. So the open content proposal is to take institutions which are already in the market, just like governments and insurance companies are already in the drug market. You already have guys that are doing reimbursements. It's not really an end user thing. It's already being done by third parties. Well, that's true for scholarly research. It's primarily paid for our education things. It's been paid through the procurement budgets of universities, libraries, and education institutions, and libraries. They're in the market. They acquire products every year. They pay for journals. They pay for books. They pay for them for their own patrons. It's basically like a little community thing. It's like a club thing. What if you said that 1 to 2% of your acquisition budget had to go on open content, and every library had to basically ensure that some fraction of what they did was to provide global public licenses for the kind of works that they buy, so that they would not be available just to the patrons of their library, but they'd be available to all patrons everywhere in the world, completely free, on the margin. And it would just become part of the budget. It would become part of the acquisition budget. You'd see schools being able to basically then would become investors in open courseware. You'd be getting licenses to allow people to remash products that were used in all kinds of reference materials and things like that. You'd be moving toward some of the efficiencies you've seen in the software area. You'd begin to see people repurposing, as you see in open source software and things like that, education materials more freely. You'd sort of see the cost on the margin of education materials falling to zero in a lot of areas. You'd sort of completely transfer. You could imagine kind of transformations in the scholarly area. It wouldn't mean that there would be no money going to the people that were creating content, but it would mean that you would not have to wait 95 years or life plus 70 years before something could be freely distributed. You'd begin to sort of acknowledge that the highest use of most of these knowledge products is when everybody has access, and it's the one thing that the intellectual property system is designed to prevent. So that's what delinkage is about. Thank you very much.
Don't go anywhere, James. We're opening it up for questions, comments, and other observations. There are microphones around, so if you have a question, a comment, or an observation, put your hand up, wait for the microphone to come, and then address James. Thank you.
Sorry. My name is Daya Senke. Possibly you would remember me.
Yeah, absolutely.
This we have been discussing this topic of delinking for quite some time, for many years maybe. And but if you look at the actual process of expansion of intellectual property rights in the last decade or so, I mean maybe a decade and a half more, 15 years or 20 years, basically this is a political process. This whole thing is a political process involving the corporate power. We have seen that, we have been arguing on this issue, that you look at the copyright, you discuss pharmaceuticals, and we have been discussing pharmaceuticals over a number of years. But look at the copyright. In USA, copyright period was extended 11 times in 40 years. It has very little to do with the actual cost of production of those copyrights. Basically what happened, that copyrights started getting owned a lot more by corporations, which had we had the Mickey Mouse law that extended it to 75, what you mentioned, 75 years, 95 years. And those 75 years, 95 years is being extended through bilateral agreements and multilateral agreements around the world. So what we are looking at, I mean, I'm making this very short, that this whole process is so political that unless we deal with the political nature of the process, this delinking to me, any access to medicine, any access to literature, any access to music, is nearly impossible unless we bring the political process, the political, just like capturing Wall Street or something, it's something like that, unless we have a very active political process, I do not see any success for this delinking process.
You want to respond to that? intellectual property making is very political, particularly, it always has been, but it's political in both an ideological way, and it's in terms of just a corporate power thing, both. I think that one insight that we had was sometimes it's easier to deal with a big idea than a small idea in intellectual property. Because when you deal with some marginal thing, if I was to take some little part of one of the 25 different ways that there's this is sort of very big abuse in the intellectual property system for pharmaceutical drugs in the United States, for example, they're so technical, they're so complicated. And you know, I couldn't explain it to my mother. I mean, it was if some of these issues like the pediatric patent extension or something like that. And if you try and mess with it, you have the entire pharma political machinery against you. No matter what the issue is, if you sort of challenge it, it's almost the same amount of opposition if you just try and blow up and nuke the whole system. The difference is if you sort of raise the stakes, you begin to kind of like communicate with a wider group of people. You begin to connect to people that might see that they might benefit from the thing. If you were to tell the public, oh, I'm going to knock 6 months off the pediatric extension of patent extensions in the United States, you're not going to go out and march in the streets for that, you know. But if you say, yeah, let's get rid of all the drug monopolies. Let's have generic drugs for everyone worldwide. Let's eliminate, you know, scarcity of new medical inventions for everybody. Well, people might march in the streets on that. That's actually, you know, and if our strength comes from the ordinary person, if it comes from the public, you gotta offer them something pretty big to get them, you know, part of their time to focus on it. So I agree with you, it's a problem. It is political, and it's a huge problem. And I think the strategy has to be, in some ways, to simplify things and raise the stakes, and not just, you know, be too much in the weeds on some little marginal reform effort, of which we work on frequently. It's difficult.
Hi. My name is Sven Feldman from Melbourne Business School.
From where?
Melbourne Business School.
Okay.
Just across the street. So, I think you made a compelling point that what the intellectual property system does is it grants monopoly exclusivity, and companies will reap benefit by restricting access and therefore capture some of the value that they create. As an example, you brought up the AIDS industry, or drug industry, in which there is a market for, I think you mentioned, $3 billion a year or $13 billion a year.
I think 13 is the sales, yeah. It's okay. Not the R&D expenditure,
so,
that's
and
for
and
sure.
You say, yeah. If you take now just $3 billion, we can buy them, or we could buy them out and generate much more value through that. The problem is, without the intellectual property market and the market for drugs, how would we possibly know how much the value of the intellectual property is being generated is? So for example, even if we look at the internet now, 10 years, 20 years after sort of it has gone viral, we can estimate that it's worth a large sum. But if we were to try to devise a system in which we compensate those who have invented it, we'd be at a loss. And so if we need an incentive for drug companies, for example, to do it, how do we have an ex-ante evaluation of the prize we need to give them? And I'm not sure if I heard it from the proposals that you sort of threw out towards the end.
Well, if you were just to take a particular disease, AIDS wasn't even recognized as a disease not that long ago. So if you were asking somebody in 1981 how much you'd spend on AIDS, they wouldn't even know what AIDS was. So I think your point is a good one, which is how would you sort of deal with both a problem and a solution you didn't really understand what it was. One of the big problems historically in the development of prize systems is this issue of how do you value the prize. And if you look at things like the Longitude Prize, of which there were several before it was finally won, and things like that, you're kind of struck in some ways by the challenge of kind of getting into this valuation thing. Now, I'll just sort of, the AIDS thing, I think, is a kind of a special thing in the United States, because the AIDS bill was done because the senator who introduced it wanted to have a discrete way to test out the prize fund in the United States in one segment of the pharmaceutical sector that wasn't really the whole thing, because he didn't really think the United States was going to like immediately do the big reform all at once, even though he supports that. He just doesn't think he thinks with the AIDS thing you could kind of try and test it out and make the case in an area where you pretty much know what the innovation needs are for the people that are existing right now, and I think it's a mature field. But let me explain how they wanted to do it for the overall thing, just to understand a bit more of the thinking behind that. You can look at the pharmaceutical R&D expenditures in the United States over the last half century, and you can go year by year, you can sort of look at what's been spent. So you have fairly good data on what outlays for R&D are. So you might say, as a starting point, if you were trying to take that particular system, you'd want to know how much money would it take to induce the same kind of private investments you had now under the current system. So if global R&D is around $80 billion right now. I don't know what the exact number is. It changes from year to year. But suppose it's around $80 billion in private investments for the year. You'd need to have, that's a risk-adjusted number, because that includes all the successes and all the failures. But you need a reward system that was bigger than that overall, globally, in order to induce those kind of private sector outlays, because they have to, it takes a while to get your money back and things like that. I think the way you'd model it, in terms of the overall fund, you can kind of get to that number. Then the second question you have is, how much do you give to a particular innovation? I think right now, if you have a cancer drug, if you have an AIDS drug, if you have a diabetes drug, what is the process right now that the individual consumer themselves, if it's a new product, is normally not the person paying for the full cost of the drug. In Australia, it would be the pharmaceutical benefits scheme. So the government itself is already making that decision as a third-party thing. They're looking at how many people use the drug, but they're also looking at what is the clinical evidence of the effectiveness of the drug. So most of the people that are looking at drug development models, what they do is, and what we started looking at earlier was the idea you create a competition for the fund. So suppose you had, like in the United States, the big proposal, which is down the road a bit, but it was like going to be $80 billion out of the U.S. market per year as a prize fund to eliminate the monopoly on all drugs in the United States. The idea is that if every drug that was in the market would put forward what their clinical evidence was of how the drugs actually worked. So you would know when a product was in the market, you would know whether it worked or it didn't work. It's the same data that you look at right now in reimbursements. And the proposals were that you'd look at it every year for 10 years. You'd have a 10-year period where every year, which is approximately the period of the effective monopoly right now under the patent system, you participate in a payday and you compete with everyone else that was also had a product in the market at the same time. And the products were better than others based on clinical evidence would get a bigger share of the pie. So people would compete for shares of a fixed fund. And the legislative proposals, they have various rules and caveats and things like that to address a lot of prize design issues. But I think that the valuation of the pharmaceutical is one of the easiest things to do, because pharmaceutical drugs are already paid for by third parties using exactly and precisely the same kind of evidence you'd use in a competition on prize funds that you're doing right now for reimbursements. The harder thing would be, what is the price of a scholarly work on the intellectual property system, or a history of the of South America or something like that? I mean, those are actually much bigger challenges in terms of valuation thing than it would be for pharmaceutical drugs.
I'm just trying to work out how some of these ideas might work in practice, and I was wondering whether some sort of economic arbitrage model is what you're driving at. And so if I can just explain how I think it might work. Monopolists typically, just for self-interest, restrict supply. And so from the examples you've given, there's a whole demand out there that would come into the market if prices were reduced. And the question is whether, using your internet example, whether there is some arbitrage mechanism whereby you could take a position in the market, buy up the capacity from the monopolist, and make the product available at the lower price, thereby providing access to all of those people who are denied access. So my question is that the kind of mechanism you're talking about, and why hasn't it been working or seem to be working so far, apart from, for example, the internet case that you mentioned?
Well, I think there are examples where things work, but let me just go to the AIDS drug example, where Gilead, which is the most successful seller of AIDS drugs right now and has the best AIDS drug combination, and Johnson & Johnson, another big company, have both given a tentative endorsement to the use of the prize fund in developing countries as follows. The idea was to take 10% of the budget of drug purchases in the Global Fund and PEPFAR and these other donor programs, and then to set aside that into a reward system that would be available only to people that license their patents to the developing world. And so it would be a voluntary mechanism, but it would be set up so that if only Gilead would license their patents, then they'd get 10% of the entire drug budget, no matter whose drugs were being purchased by the donor industry. The idea being was that donors will only donate if they get a lot of life saved for every dollar they put in. And if the prices are too high, the donors will just back off of the AIDS treatment and they'll start building bridges or doing something else in terms of a development program. And so they thought this was a basis of negotiation. They might argue whether 10% is the right number, or whether it should be 12% or some other number. But actually, it's pretty significant that two of the big pharma companies now have said that this is the right way to think about the developing country problem. Similar to this, Thailand has proposed, and some Latin American countries have proposed, that in the case of cancer drugs, that the countries put up a prize fund funded out a portion of their cancer treatment budget, and that be the trade-off for getting rid of the monopoly in a developing country on the cancer drugs. So kind of the idea is that if a country doesn't spend very much on on cancer treatment, the company that has the drugs wouldn't get much money. But on the other hand, there probably wouldn't be much treatment taking place. I mean, drugs are part of a bigger budgetary issue on cancer. So countries would be more likely to do diagnostics for cancer if they could afford the drugs. So they'd be more willing to provide other elements of the treatment process if the drugs weren't so damn expensive. Now, there's no way that most developing countries are going to test a woman to see if she's HER2 positive on breast cancer, because that just means you need a $100,000 drug, and nobody really wants to know the answer to that question. If the drug was $20 an injection, then a lot of countries would start screening for HER2 positive, and then they'd start providing other types of treatment. And then as a country grew and their budgets expanded on cancer care, more and more money would go to the guys that developed cancer drugs. So that's the idea, that you sort of look at something that you're already spending money on, like the cancer treatment budget, or your AIDS programs for developing countries, and you just say some fraction of that has to go to the innovator. Some of that has to be an innovation dividend. It has to be a payoff to the innovation. But we want to demonopolize the drugs in that sector in return for that's a sort of trade-off. It's a different business model. It's the idea that we pay a fixed part of our budget toward innovators is the other thing. So that's kind of the direction it's going there. I'm sorry, I don't think I was completely responsive to your question. But do the companies themselves negotiate internally these things? There's a lot of reasons why they don't. The companies are, you might ask yourself, why are cancer prices so high in developing countries? Because certainly in the area of AIDS, prices have come down quite a bit because of the campaigning against the patents and things like that. And it's because they feel like if they give a lower price in India for a cancer drug, that other countries will want that lower price as well. So they tend to basically, Europe is a classic problem. Now, Europe is actually interested in the cancer prize fund because there's a huge difference between Eastern Europe and Northern Europe in terms of incomes. It's an order of magnitude difference. And so because of the way the European market's structured, because of pricing contours and parallel trade and things like that, but primarily pricing contours, it's kind of the same price everywhere in Europe. It's not like the Poles are getting like this great deal or the Hungarians are getting a great deal on cancer drugs compared to the Danes. It just doesn't happen in Europe. Should it happen? I don't know. It doesn't. I mean, that's just the reality. It's just not happening. So there's like now this really unequal access in Europe of things. And so the parliament's beginning to look into this. Maybe it'd be easier to scale the payments in Europe to the cancer developing things based on the per capita income in the GDP in Poland and Hungary and Denmark than it is to sort of work out what single price makes sense for a country, a place where some countries have 10 times the per capita income than others do.
Other questions?
Hi, my name's Kate Rintle. I was wondering what plan there would be for dealing with the reluctance that some countries might have to put forward the prize money and then have everyone else in the world benefit from the incentive that their taxpayers are making in their country?
Well, right now you see a very big difference in the way people implement the patent system in the United States, in Canada and different places, and just in terms of the pricing contours. Like, prices are very different in some countries right now. So if you were to suppose, for example, that Australia just went to the prize system and you just eliminated monopolies in Australia, but Europe didn't, right? So you'd have this difference. What you did would be a domestic issue. It wouldn't necessarily carry over to what happened in Europe. I think if a big market switched on something, if you begin to see some movement, I think everything would move pretty fast. We think that if you could actually do just the AIDS program in the United States on the prize system, the benefits would be just so huge, you'd force people to ask why you don't make the switch. You can spend half as much and get twice as much access, and I think you can get more innovation. So the reason that you don't switch is not because the economics aren't good, it's because people are just basically fundamentally, unbelievably conservative about something that supposedly is about innovation. I mean, the IP system is what about creativity, innovation, inventing stuff, doing something new, different, except for what? You know, that would be the intellectual property system. That thing's supposed to be like something that was done a couple hundred years ago has to be the model for everybody forever for the next 200 years, because you can't possibly imagine messing with it, even though it's objectively not performing by any real candid economic analysis of how things are playing out. In fact, it's a complete scandal the way things play out in whole sectors of it. But it's sort of almost an emotional unwillingness to basically do the math and look at the bang for the buck and basically compare it to anything else. The intellectual property system survives by not being compared to anything except for a flat earth model of no rewards to innovators. The thing that the intellectual property system looks good at is if you compare it to nothing going to the innovator. No substitute business model. If you just eliminate IP and have nothing but generic drugs and no rewards to development, you're not going to have any new drugs, is kind of the thinking, right? So that actually is a pretty rational, not completely misplaced fear. And that's what kind of keeps it intact, is the idea is you got these two polar extreme, exclusive rights or nothing. And a lot of people would rather have 20 years of a monopoly on, for a while, you know, just to have the dynamic innovation, than move to nothing. But if you actually say, well, there's another way of approaching it, which is we'll pay money, we'll write some checks, but we're just not going to basically pay $100,000 every time some cancer patient needs Herceptin, or $25,000 every time an AIDS patient needs a triplet. We're going to do it completely differently, right? That's a system that doesn't get compared. And that's a system that would destroy the exclusive rights system and will destroy, in my opinion, in the pharmaceutical sector. And I think, actually, people are beginning to kind of move in that direction right now.
Okay, we have a final question down here.
Thanks, James. James, I'm wondering whether you understand people's skepticism when we see public policy development in areas like pharmaceuticals and patents in intellectual property being directed to questions of access through the Doha export licenses, the removal of data exclusivity to facilitate generics, public access subsidies as being a sort of an incremental and principled way of balancing private property incentives with access, as opposed to the policy prescription, as I understand it, that you're putting forward, which is to blow up the whole system, to use your words, and to remove that altogether and to replace it instead with prizes allocated, I assume, by some sort of Politburo system.
Well, could you explain to me who it is that determines the amount of reimbursement for cancer drugs in Australia?
Sorry, you're answering my question with a question, okay. What do you mean to say the operation of the pharmaceutical
benefits? Well, you're all concerned about this Politburo central planning model, right? So I just want to push back a little bit, and I think you already got central planning. I think you already have a Politburo. I think you already have a government entity. It's called the Pharmaceutical Benefits Scheme. That's who does it in Australia, and it's NICE in the UK, and it's Pharmac in New Zealand. What do you think those things are? You think that's some kind of private sector operation? These are government-backed insurance schemes where they are centrally planned and they're doing reimbursements. And what is the difference? What is the difference between deciding that you reimburse $100,000 for a particular cancer drug, or $50,000, or $15,000, or $10,000, or $3 a day for a heart disease drug? What's the difference between making that decision and deciding how to allocate X number of million or billion dollars between people that develop new drugs? Now, I'll give you one simple example to show you how completely irrational the current system would be and how you can improve it really fairly simply, aside from the fact that 90% of your money is going for something that has nothing to do with R&D to begin with, which you should admit is a problem. Now, Lipitor was a drug for heart disease, but it wasn't really the first. So let's take Zocar as an example. Zocar is on the market by Merck. Suppose that, I don't know what the price was here, but suppose that Zocar is like getting like $2 per day as a drug, and then Lipitor comes along by Pfizer, and suppose it's like 10% better, maybe 1% better. It's almost the same drug. But they claim there's some clinical evidence that Lipitor is a tiny bit better than Zocar. Rationally, it makes sense from a reimbursement point of view, from a Pharmac point of view, from a pharmaceutical benefit system, from a Aetna insurance company point of view, to give more money to Lipitor than Zocar because it's a better drug. But actually, what actually happened? If you increase the efficacy of the product by 1% or by 10%, why should you get 101% or 110% of the reward of the original product? And what happens to the originator? The originator product actually just exits the market because everybody switched to the 1% better thing. That's why you have a big Me Too product, because it's very profitable to do that. It's easier to do that. The patent protection wasn't very strong. They could engineer basically a Me Too product. That's because as long as you're linking the reward to the sale of the product, you're going to always stimulate the 1% Me Too product or the 2% or the 5% thing. And it's not that you don't want the Me Too products to come on. It's not that you don't want to incentivize follow-on products that are that are better, and it's often the case that the follow-on products are better products, but you don't want to essentially give them all of your R&D money. What you do is you're sort of starving the people that are essentially doing the more difficult, innovative work, and you're overcompensating the people that are doing the fairly lazy, innovative stuff, and that's wasteful. And you can't really fix it on the current system. But in terms of the central policy making, you're already there in drugs. That's what's different about drugs than, say, you know, the laptop computer market, which isn't really done by the government. You don't go to the government for a little coupon every time you get a laptop computer. You do for a drug. Go ahead.
Oh, well,
I was tough.
Is that a response? Or
yeah, I suppose. It seems to me that if you think of an Australian biotech startup company, and knowledge economy stuff, and you're thinking about its patent portfolio, and its listing, and the market share of that patent portfolio, at that stage of the game, when you're looking at trying to get private capital in to pay people to develop innovative, ultimately pharmaceuticals, the PBS access scheme is not on people's minds. That's if you win the prize, that's if you have a successful product and there is a need for access, but at that stage you're looking at some very basic decisions as to where capital should flow, and it's not determined by the Politburo.
I think that if you're trying to develop a drug in Australia, you can eliminate the patent system in terms of the domestic market completely, like India did. And it wouldn't make any difference in the domestic R&D industry, because you'd be basically looking at the United States and European market as the essential payoff for the development of the drug. I think that the domestic market for most developers outside of the United States is really not the primary consideration. Certainly in Switzerland, they're not looking at the Swiss market for cancer drugs when they develop cancer drugs out of Novartis or Roche. They're looking at basically the bigger markets or the global market. Now, in terms of the biotech thing, biotechs essentially develop products and sell them off, in a lot of cases, to big companies that have huge, huge, huge workforces. Those are people that, if the patents, you know, if the reward system is doing well, should get a raise out of the system. They shouldn't take a pay cut. And you laugh about that, but you have to ask yourself, what do you think the average royalty is for biotech firms in terms of final products, and how much of the total, you know, nearly trillion-dollar market that people spend every year is really going to that end of the market? You can essentially, you don't know anything about the details of the things they've been working on, but certainly people in the small firm sector have been part of the discussions, and it's not about starving the people with the petri dishes. That are working on R&D. In fact, in the early discussions with Aventis, we said, we want the guys that are doing the R&D part of your business, we want those guys to get a raise. What we don't want to pay for is all the people that are buying pizzas for, you know, all the detail guys that are, you know, they're doing pizzas for the doctors, or all the sort of, all the other aspects of the thing, which is so incredibly wasteful. So we said to Aventis, how many of your workers work in R&D? And they said 7,000. And we said, how many people work for the firm? Well, it was 7,000 was less than 10% of their overall workforce. So we asked, well, what are the other 70,000 people doing? And they said they sell the drugs. That was a big pharma problem. The big problem is that they have 10 people selling the drug for everyone that's working on R&D. And so they're not interested in something that just rewards R&D, because they're essentially this big fixed cost machine, which is very expensive to maintain, which sells the drugs. And our whole system of pharmaceuticals is more about the salesman than it is about the R&D sector. So you can have an argument about how big a prize fund should be, but not about whether or not a prize fund could be a more efficient way of getting money to R&D than the current system. The current system is getting 9 cents on the dollar to the R&D right now. You can do better than that. You can argue about whether or not the US proposal, which was $80 billion a year for the whole pharmaceutical market, should have been $88 billion or something like that. You'd have a hard time persuading me that they've lowballed the number, but you know, you could actually double that number and still be spending less than the government's spending right now on drugs. So at a certain point, you're just arguing about how big the prize fund should be, not about whether or not a prize fund could work or not.
Okay, I now call on Janelle Borum, a councillor at IPTA, and someone who has helped me with bringing together this evening to close this. Thank you.
Thank you. On behalf of Melbourne Law School and the Institute of Patent and Trademark Attorneys of Australia, and also our supporting sponsors, I'd like to convey our thanks to James Love for delivering this third Francis Scurry lecture. And I found your ideas on the alternative mechanisms for funding things such as new drug cycles very interesting, and clearly our questions show that there'll be a lot of discussion after this lecture. So I think that's always the main aim of these lecture series. But also I think the ideas for music funding where the users have the political power, very interesting too. And as a person with Scottish heritage who was a Highland dancer in her youth, I think I'd be spending my money on bagpipes. I think there's still a need for intellectual property professionals in this environment too to decide whether a band that has bagpipe music playing in the musical interlude is worthy of funding from that bagpipe music fund, equally to the bagpipers who are standing on their own on stage. So would you all please join me in a round of applause to thank our speaker, James Love.